Okay, today is May 10th, 2013. This is an interview with Chris Orevec. This is a phone interview. I'm here in Madison, Wisconsin, and Chris, I believe you're in St. George, is that correct?
Yes, it's St. George, Utah, and my first name is Christine.
Okay, so we'll go with the formal Christine.
I could go with Chris, it's okay.
Okay. And today, let's say I got the date, and we're doing this interview to talk to Chris about her time here in Madison in the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. So Chris, as I said earlier, I'm going to ask you now to state your name. You can do full name and spell your last name so we can get the sound quality as good as possible.
Okay. My full name is Christine Lena Orevec. My middle name is Lena, L-E-N-A. My last name is Orevec, and I'll spell it. It's O-R-A-V, as in Victor, E-C.
Great. And just to confirm, you're fine with me calling you Chris during the...
Oh, yeah, that's fine.
Okay. All right, Chris, the first question, I should mention that you and I met in Salt Lake last year at a presentation I gave, and that you and I have been communicating via email since then about possibly doing this interview. And so we've talked a little bit about the topics. So you know to a great extent what's coming here. So my first question is very simply, why UW-Madison?
Well, I went to college at Lawrence University in Appleton after having grown up in Chicago, Illinois. And Madison was the next location for graduate work. It was the likely choice because it was in-state tuition. And I wanted to go out of state, but couldn't because of the price. So I went to Madison.
Okay. So if I may back up a little bit, what drew you to Lawrence to do your undergrad?
Lawrence University was one of the two colleges that I went to. The first college that I went to was North Park College in Chicago, a parochial school run by the Swedish Covenant Church. I went there for 2 years, and then I transferred to Lawrence University in Appleton. During that entire time, there was various levels of anti-draft, anti-war activity going on in Chicago, and I experienced quite a bit of it, both directly and indirectly. Basically grew up with it.
Okay. Chris, I think right now I'd like to give you space. You said you grew up with it. I want to give you space for something you said you wanted to talk about, and that's your family's history of anti-war activity, if you don't mind me saying it that way. If you want to give you some space here to talk about your family's involvement in anti-war activities.
Right. I kind of think of it as anti-draft because it dealt with my adult father and grandfather. When I did my genealogy, trying to find the origins of my name and my nationality, I discovered that my grandfather had systematically changed his birth date and particularly the birth year on all of his immigration papers. Soon after that, I discovered that that was a common occurrence among young men who are reaching the age of 18 in Middle Europe to avoid the draft. And then my father had a long history of anti-draft activities. He resisted the draft after he was inducted in 1941. He went underground and stayed there until 1944. He was pursued by the FBI along with his brother, whom he took care of, and both of them basically disappeared off the map. They hid out in various locations, and finally the FBI caught up with them. He went to trial. He defended himself, and he was sent to a minimum security prison in upper Minnesota called Sandstone. There he met some of his friends from the borders of the mafia world. Many mafiosi did not want to be involved in a war against Italy. And many Middle Eastern Europeans found no reason to want to be involved in a war since they or their parents had escaped Middle Europe because of the Austro-Hungarian draft and the constraints of living under that empire, impressment, for example. So there is, and eventually he was released in 1944, and throughout my young life I was thoroughly indoctrinated in the idea of resisting the draft and anti-war in general. Although he was not a conscientious objector, he had no religious or philosophical objections. He just didn't want young men to be killed.
Okay. So, Chris, I think you've alluded to this in a couple of your answers, but I want to ask it directly. And that's, personally, were you involved in Vietnam-era protest prior to coming here to UW-Madison?
Yes, I was. I was in that. I'd been going to that small college in Chicago, North Park, and it was in a pretty safe neighborhood on the north side. However, during that time was the entire activity that was going on in 1967, 1968 in Chicago. I watched all the protests on TV, the Democratic Convention. They were only 20 miles away from where I lived. I lived under the curfew that was imposed on the city during the time of Martin Luther King riots. And I was exposed at North Park to the lectures of William Stringfellow, who was part of the group who protested at the Pentagon and spilled blood on the steps of the Pentagon. He was a theologian, and he gave me a rationale for the anti-war leanings that I had been exposed to. And then when I transferred to Lawrence, we had the experience of being in session during the Kent State activity, and we watched it on television in the Union. The group of students wanted to go out on strike because the Eastern schools, Yale, Harvard, and so forth, that we had modeled ourselves after, at Lawrence being a small four-year college in Upper Wisconsin, were going out on strike. And so about a week after they went out on strike, Yale and Harvard and so forth, we went out on strike. It was a very, very benign and communitarian kind of activity, very civil. We got together in the chapel. We voted ourselves out, including the president, Tom Smith, and we immediately, as a group, went on to do petitioning, marches. We went to the county building. We had candlelight vigils. We saw guards with rifles in the windows of the county building, and did that kind of activity. Went in front of the draft board on College Avenue, and then in a very civil fashion, we came back together the following week and voted ourselves back into session after everything had sort of simmered down nationwide. That was my idea of what protest was at the time at Lawrence University. Interesting, events along the way. Rennie Davis came to speak on campus. He was extraordinarily powerful. He had a wonderful economic argument. And one of our former presidents, Curtis Tarr, was actually the guy that pulled the balls out of the draft number balls out of the cage. President of Lawrence University pulling draft numbers out of the cage. Some of our young men wore their draft numbers on their forehead to demonstrate that they were indeed, had been, in a sense, branded by this rather traumatic event. So my experience at Lawrence during the 2 years I tried to finish my undergraduate degree was quite eventful.
It sounds like it, and thank you for sharing it. So I'd like to talk to you about when you arrived on the Madison campus. If I remember right, it might have just been just after the Sterling Hall bombing?
Yes, it was after, and some folks might consider considerably after. I did not. I didn't really understand anything about the Sterling Hall bombing. I may have heard about it at Lawrence, but I was in this other, more constrained world. When I arrived on campus in that summer of, 71, I met my future husband and current husband, Joe, And we courted by going around at night, walking around the beautiful Madison campus. One night he took me to see the foundations, or what was left, I mean the whole, not even foundations, of Sterling Hall. It was extremely dark, there were no lights, and it was entirely surrounded with chain link fence. It was a huge hole. I remember being extraordinarily impressed by how big that building was and how the fact that they had to take the whole thing out. At that point, then, I realized the significance of Sterling Hall, because nothing like that had ever happened in my immediate experience. I had seen riots, I had been involved in protests, but I had never really come in confrontation with the actual physical event of something so large. And that was my initial and most primary impression of Sterling Hall. After that point, I continued to be interested in what was going on in terms of protests on the Madison campus, which continued on, in fact, after having that experience of seeing the hole.
So let's talk about that then. You want to talk a little bit about your specific involvement here on this campus in the student protest movement. Do you remember? Let's start off by asking if maybe you remember the first protest you attended, and go from there.
Well, that's a little bit foggier in my mind. First protests, there were lots of protests that were going on at the time, so it was hard to tell exactly what and when. There were activities that were going on around me quite considerably. For example, we were sitting on the lawn chairs outside of the student union against Lake Mendota there one evening, knowing that there was going to be a big protest coming, and watching the sunset over Lake Mendota and the ducks kind of paddling around the boats and everything. And pretty soon a whole line of military vehicles drove up onto the path, the concrete that formed the piers outside the union, and bunches of National Guard started pouring out of these military vehicles with their weapons, all dressed in camouflage and boots. We looked at them, and so did the rest of the folks that were out there eating ice cream cones and doing everything else that you do there. With a kind of a glazed amazement, that knowing that there was going to be something happening, knowing that there was going to be some kind of confrontation in the next 12 to 24 hours. As we began realizing that this was heavy stuff, as I began realizing that this was heavy stuff that was going to be occurring, I became less and less involved, in part because I was afraid. We were both graduate students, Joe and I, and we lived in Whitty Hall, which at that time was the graduate student residence. And we were able to look down from the rooms up above onto the commons area, where there was a cafeteria right next to Whitty, and you could look out towards the State Street area from Whitty, although you couldn't quite see State Street. On a night probably pretty close to that event, of seeing the armed personnel, we watched as there were protests that occurred on State Street, and the crowds were being broken up by police officers marching in phalanx, that is, in V shapes, down the streets with their batons held in their hands, flailing and marching at knee step pace. In other words, they were running, but their knees were coming up at 90-degree angles and rushing, blocking the streets, pushing protesters down the streets and into and scattering them into the campus. Some of them scattered down into the area near the place where we would have our cafeteria lunches. And as the protesters came down there, they smashed the windows of the cafeterias, and followed immediately by the police. We watched one fellow being hunted down by three or four police officers with raised batons, hit and struck down and then taken away. And we were doing all this from the windows of our very safe little graduate school rooms up in Whitty. And we knew what was happening in part because there was information that was percolating up these towers. The towers themselves were symbolic, by the way. It was explained to us by various radical groups that they were going to, that we were being disempowered by being put into these very buildings that were very anonymous and very tall. But the information percolated up. One of Joe's friends, who eventually became a roommate of his, was a pre-med student, and he was down there taking care of protesters that had been hit by tear gas and by billy clubs. And so there was an impromptu medical location on the first or second floor of Whitty Hall, where the protesters were being brought in out of the way of the police and taken care of by students, graduate students, pre-med students who were doing first aid on them. That impression was extraordinarily powerful to me. I determined that I was not going to be involved in that kind of protest because I valued my head, and that there was no opportunity. There was nothing like the kind of civic, you know, sort of liberal-mindedness that had gone on at Lawrence University, where we all came together and voted ourselves out. No, this was definitely students versus police. I think I became radicalized more as a result of seeing that than almost anything else, because after that point, I began to see the Sterling Hall bombers as being sympathetic figures. I learned more and more about them. They were, information about them was being disseminated, and I realized that this was no longer a nonviolent protest. That what they had done was something that was that seemed to be inevitable. I had personally almost no affiliation or sympathy or even identification with Dr. Fasnacht. Who was tragically killed as a result of that event. Later on, of course, I came to realize that many people were victimized by that event. But at the time, the radicalization process had pretty much polarized me after having seen and witnessed those kinds of things. Friends of mine coming in, you know, saying, oh, you know, I've just come back from my office, and I was tear gassed as I came out of the door of my office building. You know, things like that radicalized me greatly.
excuse me. Chris, do you have any memories then of Carl Armstrong's capture? I assume it was in 72, so I assume you were still on campus at that time.
Yes. Perhaps I do, but I don't remember it now.
Okay.
The details around Sterling, excuse me, the details around Sterling were all part of activities that became more and more focused on localized and immediate events. Protests on State Street, bonfires, blockages. At that time, State Street was not a mall. It was a regular street. And one of the issues that had become involved in the whole anti-war, the whole unionization process was, well, we're going to make State Street into a people's mall, a pedestrian mall. The conflation of some of these issues was part of what made that time so chaotic. And that impacted you should you be on the edges of that. For example, we were eating in a Lebanese restaurant on State Street for Sunday night dinner because they didn't serve on Sunday night in the dormitory. So very quickly, the owners of the restaurant said to us, you must leave by the back door, did not go out the front door. Well, they took the rugs that were on the floor and they put them up against the edges of the door, and they had us all go back behind into the alley and back to our dormitory areas. And it turned out that the tear gas was coming down from State Street from these various protest activities that started with the blockages of State Street. That happened, I believe, about a year or so after the period of time of the Sterling Hall bombing. But this was also during a time when people were trying to do graduate research, trying to go to classes and get jobs and things like that. And I was sensitized to it to a great degree because I was sensitized to it, but many of my graduate fellows were confused and disturbed that their educational process had been disrupted in this way. I did not continue to be involved in the anti-war activity on campus, knowing that it could become and had become quite violent.
Chris, I wonder if you could talk, or if you would talk about the relationship you had as a graduate student with your faculty, mm-hmm. and if you think it was affected by the Vietnam War.
Absolutely. No question about it. Pardon me. This also is intimately involved in the TAA, or the Teaching Assistants Association stuff. But I think when that population of students that arrived around 1970, 71, 72 came on campus, there had already been a rift that had occurred. It was rumored, the story that was told me, was that the English department was the center of activity, and that one of the strategies that was cooked up by the administration with the faculty support was to reduce the number of English TAs so that there would not be as much agitation coming from that direction. And so there had been a decision to reduce the number of requirements for taking basic composition. The basic composition course was basically eliminated as a prerequisite for many programs. That reduced the number of English TAs. By the time I got onto campus then, a TA was considered to be a source of radical, if not violent, activity. And then as that segued into the Teaching Assistants Association activity, I came to be in the position of doing such things as standing outside my own home building, Vilas Hall, and attempting to persuade my professors not to enter because we were striking Vilas Hall. You can imagine these are the people who are going to be writing our recommendation letters for getting academic or other kinds of jobs in the future. So yes, there was that kind of tension, and the faculty was fully in support of the administration at the time. The administration was perceived by the more radical students as being primarily businessmen, people with MBAs and possibly a minor academic degree, who were going to turn us all into punch cards and numbers, and were going to manipulate our lives by doing things like reducing the numbers of composition courses. This, of course, was the ideology of the time, but it did increase the tension. For example, I took a course, an actual course, in the rhetoric of the American Revolution at the same time that I was out protesting and striking. And my teacher was extraordinarily conservative. I couldn't understand how this person could be arguing the arguments of the American Revolution at the same time as resisting the protesters on campus.
Chris, I wonder if you want to talk a bit more about the Teaching Assistant Association, the TAA. Let's start off by, I'll ask, did you become involved as you got to campus, or was it something you became involved in after a time?
It was after a time, because there was a short period of time when I did not have an academic home on campus. I transferred from the English department to the communication department, and there was an intervening year which I in which I was not a student, but I did join the union once I became a TA in the communication department, and that was in 1973. The communication department was radicalized concerning TAA activities fairly early because we had a unionizer among us, my friend, who became my very close friend. In fact, we all became couples friends and did activities with each other socially. She made sure that her home department was politicized. She talked to all of us about the issues involved in the TAA that in that particular year of 1973, 1974, it had to do with things like such as class size, had to do with working conditions. We could not bargain salaries because it was against the law. State employees could not bargain salaries. But quite a few people would not have wanted to bargain salaries, and I did not want to because their salaries were already so high because of previous TAA activities that they were among the best in the nation, if not only second to Michigan's. We were brought in on the basis of working conditions, and so it was nearly impossible for my department in communication not to be involved almost to a TA. And we did such things, as I said, picketing our building. We engaged in big rallies. We were taught, for the first time, I was taught the old unionizing songs that were mimeographed on sheets of paper and passed among us. That was part of our union heritage. We didn't know about that, but here it was. And we also went to training sessions. I did not go to training sessions during my anti-war activity, but I did go to training sessions during my TAA activity because I wanted to know what to do in case I were to be arrested. And so I went down to the YWCA, and we got training sessions on how to be good passive resistors in the sense of the Saul Alinsky tradition. I was introduced to Saul Alinsky. I was introduced to that whole organized form of protest that I had always, up to that point, saw only in terms of either nonviolent civic action or in terms of extreme violence. And so the TAA kind of finished off my education in terms of radicalization.
Thank you, Chris. Excuse me. How long did you and your husband stay on the Madison campus?
We stayed until 1977. We were both hired. He left in 76, I believe, having just completed all of his PhD requirements for a computer science degree, but not wanting to do the dissertation. And he was hired by a company in the Twin Cities. And for a year, I was in Madison, he was in the Twin Cities, and then during that year I had finished my coursework, had started my dissertation, I was recruited and got a job at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, Utah. Fortunately, there was also a major plant of the company that he worked for, the Unisys Corporation. Formerly it was Sperry Univac. in Salt Lake, so he put in for a transfer, and the transition was flawless. We both came to Salt Lake City, Utah, without having to decide whose career was going to be prioritized, and if we had to split up in order to both get jobs. So we had a rather smooth transition there. So in 1977, I came to Salt Lake City. Completed my dissertation in Madison, came back to Madison in 1979, completed my dissertation, and apparently I got good recommendation letters because I wouldn't have gotten the job if I hadn't.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I want to ask a question that might not be easy to answer, mm-hmm. and that's, can you point to a time where the Vietnam-era protests ended on campus, or was it a gradual declination of students protesting the war? Do you have any memories or thoughts about that?
Yeah, I would say it was a gradual declination because, as I mentioned, the issues began to get muddled soon after, I would say, the 1972-73 period. The issues began to become more localized. They began to have more to do with university politics and with teaching issues. They had to do with things like a State Street Mall. All of it was a mix of political and cultural elements. I hope this is not too abstract, but it was a mixture of political and cultural elements that were began to be focused very locally into the Madison realm, detaching itself to some degree from the national movements. So that by 1974, when you had the withdrawal and so forth, it really wasn't an issue anymore. There were some pockets, of course. I lived near the Mifflin Street area. I went to get my groceries at the Mifflin Street Co-op. I mean, they still had Che Guevara's poster up on the wall. They still had the North Vietnamese flag over the cash register, which I thought was just a hoot. But that was beginning to become more constrained, more reduced. And by the time of the time that I left campus, 1977, I had already begun to be involved in civic improvement projects that were an extension. I mean, it was an extension of the bonfires on State Street. Paul Soglin had decided, once he became mayor, that he was going to gentrify State Street, and suddenly we were having community meetings talking about where we wanted to put the planters on the pedestrian mall, and where we wanted to have the cars go, and where we were going to keep the cars from going. And suddenly it all became very yuppified. And that was in completion by 1976. So I would say, yes, the fall off was fairly sudden. It was anti-war activity really was over by 73, if not 74, and it had become a very mixed kind of localized sort of thing.
Okay. A very big, broad, big picture, broad question here, and mm-hmm. and that is, how do you feel that you're, well, 6 years here on campus, but really it sounds like the first three when the protests about the war were still going on. How do you think that shaped you as a human being?
Oh, wow. I thought I was talking big picture because I don't know any of the principles involved in the Sterling Hall stuff, and I'm certainly talking big picture when it comes to my activity because I was pretty much elevated above it all. I was watching it. But watching it was crucial. Watching it happen. I don't think, unless you have seen actual troops on your campus that were sent there in order to keep you in line, casually taking out their rifles and stacking them up next to the picnic tables, I don't think that you can watch that and not be changed. Okay? I don't think that you can see kids being billy clubbed from above, much like being in an airplane watching bombing occur, that you cannot be changed, because at that point you begin to realize that once you become a member of a perceived mass, you are no longer identified as an individual, certainly not a special individual. And that, to me, consolidated my orientations toward such things as the draft, as war, as protests. From then on, I showed up to Iraq war protests. I showed up to unionization protests in Salt Lake City. I went down to First and First South and State Street to the Federal Building to an anti-Iraq war protest, and guess who showed up? Abby Hoffman, for goodness sakes. And to see him get a crowd, to start stomping and hooting and shouting and yelling and singing within 5 minutes of his arrival was an amazing thing. That has changed me, and I attribute it to that very intense experience. I think that if I had just had my family's anti-war activity, I may have reacted against that activity a little bit more by way of rebellion. Certainly my family did not want me involved in anti-war activity because they knew what it meant. It meant prison. It meant jail. It meant the FBI. It meant being on what at that time was not the top 10 most wanted list, but it certainly was beginning to be the top 10 most wanted list. My father could not walk into a post office, for example, during the period from 1941 to 1944, because his picture was on the wall. But to see it happen to me as an individual, because I was a student, made it impossible for me to ever see and completely buy into the gradual waning of that kind of attitude of anti-establishmentarianism and resistance. I can always see two sides now on almost all the issues that confront us today, and it's very, very difficult not to continue to reference those experiences as the beginning of a continued ability to have that perspective. I don't do it as much as I used to, but I certainly empathize with it, and I can feel it when, for example, I watched for hours and hours as the unionization, anti-unionization protests occurred in Madison last year. I watched television for hours. I picked up the feed for hours. I watched Ed Schultz for hours because I knew what it felt like. I knew what it was like to be there. It lasts that long. It lasts for a lifetime.
Chris, maybe one more thing before I give you the last word. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious as to how your experience as a TA, if you've thought about it, how it affected your relationship with your students when you became a faculty at the U.
When I became a faculty at the University of Utah.
Yes.
It made it, well, perhaps you know Utah, but maybe I don't have to go into that in much detail. But it was like being thrown back 20 years, okay? It became immediately apparent that there's a lot of work to be done. for example, I offered courses in which I made sure that my students were exposed to major statements about perhaps not directly anti-war activity, but certainly major civil rights statements of the time. You see, living in Chicago, we also had exposure to the Martin Luther King activity and the, you know, that kind of thing. I made sure that they read or heard the I Have a Dream speech. I made sure that they read a letter from Birmingham Jail. I made sure that they knew about the feminist movement that came out of the anti-war activity. I made sure some of my colleagues taught direct courses in anti-war activity, but I did the best I could within what I could teach. I tried to make sure that they knew that whatever they prejudices they had against those scruffy protesters needed to be seen in the light of what was necessary to be done in order to get to the place where they were today. And I tried to do it within the very, very immediate and pretty powerful conservative constraints of this culture. I tried to do teaching in such a way so that panel discussions over controversial issues were broached in settings where it was nearly impossible to address controversial issues directly. So we would have a panel, people of all sides expressing themselves. It did affect the way I taught. It affected the way I dealt with my students. It did affect a good deal of the content of what I teach. You must understand that communication deals with the movement of people towards some kind of purpose, whether it be through public speaking or the media. So it was extraordinarily easy for me to translate that experience into what I was teaching about. I did not try to indoctrinate. What I tried to do was simply expose and to make public what had happened during those years in such a way so that people would understand that it wasn't stereotyped, that it wasn't just one way of looking at things.
Chris, thank you. Now I want to leave you space if there's anything you want to say about your time in Madison or the Vietnam era or anything you think it's important to get on the historic record before we shut it down for the day.
Haven't I talked enough? I don't know what time it is. Oh, okay. I've been pretty efficient. I have never been someone who leads. I'm not an initiator. I'm definitely a follower. But I'm a very good and loyal follower. And once I'm convinced of something, I kind of see it through the end. I'm one of those people that my parents worried about, that I would be a sheep that was led along until I was led to the slaughter. My involvement was anonymous. It was not something that I necessarily saw as being historic. It was not something I saw as having an impact on history, on life, on culture, that anybody would remember it in the future. I simply did it because I thought it was right. And I did it in part because there were enough people around me who thought it was right. I don't think I would have been alone. I don't think I would have started it. However, I was one of those people who kept it going. And I see it as a continuing stream. I see it as something that came out of a period of time in the past. And I've always seen it this way, even as a child. A period of time in the past where hundreds of years, thousands of years of peasantry, of oppression, of paying taxes, not being able to move from one estate to the next without a pass, not being able to marry until you have served your time in the emperor's army, not being able to make a living because of all of the levies that were placed upon your output, very much a serf-like existence, hundreds of years of this, had culminated in an opportunity to break that mold. I felt myself to be part of that great big movement of history. I felt myself to be part of it, and if I didn't play my part, I would somehow be not true to all of those people before me that had led to where I am now. All of my grandparents were immigrants. But three of them, I could not have spoken to in English. I only knew one, and she spoke Polish. I was the chosen one. My parents did not have a high school education. They were ashamed of their background. They did not tell me where I came from. I was part of a enormous movement that started before I was born, and I was thrust into the chore of bringing my people to realizations about who they were and how could they determine their future. I see that activity as part of it. I see that activity as part of it. When people today talk about immigrants as having no or low IQs, when they demand that a woman with 5 or 6 children who are working at 3 or 4 jobs and doesn't have the correct immigration papers take a course in English in order to be able to drive or to get services from the government or from society, I think of my grandmother. I think of my grandmother. That is the way that traditions are made. This particular tradition of not wanting to be impressed into a war that no one understands and only goes to make the city of Vienna even more golden and brilliant. Not wanting to put your body out there on the line to become cannon fodder for a war that which is anonymous. Not wanting to participate in that anymore. That is my freedom. That is the legacy that my grandparents gave to me. How could I not have continued that? How could I not have done anything within my power to do that? But to do that in a way in which I would not be left on the field of battle with my head bashed in. To do that in a way so that I could gain the opportunity to have a career, to teach, to publish, to become part of the middle class, for goodness sakes, and then to be able to pass on that story. How could I not do that? How could I not have those aspirations? I guess that's all I need to say.
Well, Chris, I want to talk to you off camera, so to speak.
Okay.
But so I want to conclude by saying thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And this concludes the interview with Chris Orevec.